We're continuing this morning in our series of studies on Old and New Testament characters seen against their times. Last week we talked about Abraham and his call to be a blessing in the midst of his time. And this morning we want to look at the call and commission of Moses as it's found in the third chapter of Exodus. Let me give you a bit of historical background in order to provide the setting for our study. And before we read chapter 3, about 50 years before Moses was born, the Egyptians drove from the land of Egypt a group of foreign kings. They were called the Hyksos, or shepherd kings, foreign rulers that they came to despise. They were Asiatics. They came from Syria and Palestine. And for about 200 years, they dominated Egyptian politics. And as a result of their domination, the Egyptians came to hate Asiatics, people from the area of Syria or Palestine, and particularly shepherds, because these people were semi-nomadic, shepherd life in their background, and so they were despised. And as a result of the rule of the Hyksos, the Egyptians instituted two national policies, one of expansion. They determined that they would forever drive these people out of their borders, and so they conquered all of Syria and Palestine, and then they turned their attention inward to elements of Semitic or Asiatic life within Egypt. And the people that were most nearly identified with the Hyksos were the children of Israel. They were living in the same general area, the Nile Delta, and because they, like the Hyksos, had been Asiatic, the Egyptians decided to oppress them, to exterminate them. As you know, their policy was one of both oppression and extermination. As the nation multiplied, they determined to destroy them by killing the newborn children. And as it was during this time that Moses was born. And I'm sure you know the account. He's described in the book of Exodus as a beautiful child. That's interpreted for us in Acts as beautiful to God. God saw him in a very special way. God had a particular task for this child. And out of faith, his mother, Jochebed, prepared a little papyrus ark for him and placed him in the Nile. And in the providence of God, the Nile carried him into the arms of the daughter of the Pharaoh, whom we know. Her name was Hatshepsut. Became one of the most powerful women in Egyptian history. She actually became a pharaoh at one point in her life. Ruled for about 20 to 25 years, adopted male dress, wore a false beard, ruled over Upper and Lower Egypt. Very powerful woman, perhaps one of the most powerful women in history. And this was God's way of providing for his man. It's always seemed ironic to me that the means that the Egyptians employed to exterminate the Israelites became the means for their deliverance. It was the decree to destroy the children that resulted in Moses being taken into Pharaoh's household. For about 40 years, he was trained in the Egyptian court. And we know something of the sort of training he received. He received the very best, placed in the hands of special scribes of the court. He was trained as a mathematician and in military strategy, in chemistry, in medicine, in law. Learned the very complicated hieroglyphic system of writing. It took years to master. And in every way was trained as a leader. Received the very best that Egypt could offer. Josephus, the Jewish historian, tells us that at one time Moses was a general in the Egyptian army and was part of Egypt's expansion, as a part of their expansionist policy. He conquered for Egypt the land of Ethiopia. It was there that he gained his Ethiopian wife, which his sister Miriam later despised. And all that's background and not particularly edifying, but it helps us to understand something of the situation of Moses' birth and early life. He received the best sort of training that any young man could receive at that time. We know something of the philosophies of Egypt at that time. I mentioned last week that Egypt was in a time of depression when Abraham went there. At this time, they were in a time of ascendancy, the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. Their kingdom extended from the Euphrates down into Ethiopia. They had colonies on Cyprus and even in the Aegean Sea. Very powerful people. They believed in their strength. In fact, the monuments make statements to that effect. He trusted in his strength. That statement occurs in, with respect to some of the pharaohs. One pharaoh was interred with his bow. And inscribed on the bow is a statement, no other man could draw this bow. The philosophy was mucho macho. Strength, power, might makes right. And that was the environment that Moses was raised in. So you can see something of his thinking as he went out, saw, as we know from the account, a pharaoh mistreating one of his brothers, a fellow Hebrew. We know that the Egyptians were very cruel. They're pictured on the monuments. Slave masters beating the slaves. They're very cruel, harsh people. When Moses went out and saw one of his brothers, saw them being mistreated, he acted in the way that he felt was most appropriate. He wanted to set things right. He was the Redeemer. And as you know, he set God's program back for 40 years. He went out with all of his strength, with all of his power, and the net result was frustration, both for his people, for himself, and for 40 years, the nation remained in bondage. You ever feel that way? You set out to right some wrong, put things right, and the result is frustration and destruction. And you end up, as Moses did, sitting on a well in Midian, a long way from home, wondering, what in the world did I do wrong? My heart was right. I put everything I had into it. I even ventured a great deal of myself. And the result is negative, destructive. See, the issue was this. Moses had learned what he needed to learn in Egypt. There was nothing wrong with the instruction he received there. It was necessary, I believe, in terms of his leadership to lead 2.5 million people through the Sinai Peninsula into the Promised Land. It required that sort of education. It was not to be despised. It was in the providence of God. But Egypt had taught Moses all that it could teach him. Now God had to teach him something entirely different, something new, that only he could only learn through humiliation, through loneliness, through misery, through despair. And thus begins the second 40 years of Moses' life. Moses spent 40 years in training in the Egyptian court, and then he spent 40 years in training under God's hand in the Sinai Desert. For 40 years, he was herding sheep. Moses was a cattleman. And despised sheep, I'm sure, and certainly with his coming out of the Egyptian culture, it was even more difficult to herd sheep. He was lonely, homesick. He named one of his children Gershom, which in Hebrew means a stranger there. And I don't think he was talking about the fact that he was a stranger in Midian, because he would have used a different word that would mean a stranger here. He's talking about his relationship with the people in Egypt. He now is a stranger there. He was forgotten. No one knew him there. 40 years is a long time. Most of us haven't even lived that long. I was in, my family took the tour of Alcatraz yesterday, and they told us about the Birdman of Alcatraz, who spent 39 years in solitary. Well, Moses spent one more year than the Birdman of Alcatraz. There's every indication that his marriage was unhappy. Perhaps he felt that that finding a wife in Midian somehow would take away the pain. But Zipporah comes across throughout the pages of Scripture as a very tyrannical, hostile sort of woman. In fact, in the most trying period of Moses' life, he had to send her home. She was a burden to him. And his father-in-law, Reuel, doesn't seem to have been a great deal of help. It was a terrible, terrible time for Moses. And he'd understand that. There's nothing joyful about being in the wilderness for 40 years. Terrible time. But it was God's time. And Moses learned through that experience something that he couldn't learn at any other time. And we need to take that to heart. If you're going through circumstances that to you are reminiscent of Moses' circumstances, then you're there because God has something to teach you that He can't teach you anyplace else. We pick up the story of Moses' call in chapter 3. Chapter 2, verses 23 through 25 tell us that another king had arisen in Egypt, and by this time oppression was a national policy. The sons of Israel sighed because of their bondage and cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage came up to God, so God heard their groaning, and God remembered His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the promise that through Abraham He would make a great nation, and He would give them a land, and through the patriarchs, the seed would come who would bless the world. And God saw the sons of Israel, and literally God knew. He knew. So if you find yourself where the children of Israel were, God sees, God knows. He knows. So He sets about, as we have recorded in chapter 3, to send the deliverer back. Bring his people out of bondage. And at this point, Moses is anything but willing to go. Now, Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush, probably one of these gnarled acacia trees that grow in the desert. Nothing particularly spectacular about the bush, except that the angel of the Lord appeared in the bush, in the midst of the bush. And Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. See, Moses thought he was forgotten. But God knew him. God saw. Then he said, Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Moses thought it was desert. God says it's holy ground. In the East, they wore shoes or sandals to protect their feet from defilement. And when they walked into a holy place, they would take off their shoes in order not to defile that place, to leave the defilement outside. And God says, The place you're standing is holy. Moses says, I've been herding sheep here for 40 years. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their suffering. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from the land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Amorite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. And now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the impression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. I want you to note two things about this passage. The first is this. God says, I will deliver my people, and I'm going to do it through you. You have to connect verse 8 and verse 10. I have come down to deliver them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you. That's the only way God can work, is through people. He doesn't fly gospel blimps. He works through people. And He works through weak, inadequately prepared, ill-equipped people, because that's the only people He can use. That's the only kind of people He can find. Because no one would have been prepared to take on this task. No one. Not even Moses with his training. There wasn't any man on the face of the earth who would have been trained adequately to fulfill that task. No one. The king at this time in Egypt was a man by the name of Amenhotep II. He lived in an immense complex of palaces at Thebes. The complex of buildings was much larger than the Oakland Coliseum. And Moses was a little out of practice. He'd forgotten the court protocol. He'd been in the wilderness. And to walk into a situation like that and to proclaim that he was the deliverer, he wasn't ready for that. Secondly, God, who is never embarrassed to call us to do the impossible thing, reminds him that he's to deliver the children of Israel out of Egypt into Canaan. The problem was that the Egyptians had conquered Canaan. Not only were the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and all these other ites in the land, the Egyptians were there too. The pharaohs that had preceded this time had conquered all of Syria and Palestine. And to deliver the nation of Israel out of Egypt into Canaan would be to take them from the frying pan to the fire. There was hardly any place on the face of the earth you could go that there weren't Egyptians. And besides, he had to take 2.5 million people. Do you know how many people that is? That's something like twice the population of San Francisco County. If you were to march them in a column of fours, they would stretch for 370 miles. That's a lot of people. You have to feed them, protect them. And they'd come with their dogs and cats and parakeets and senior citizens and little children and their mattresses. And remember, they were slaves. They didn't have an army. The task was impossible. No one was equipped for a task like that. And God says, Moses, I'm calling you. I'm going to deliver my people, and you're going to do it. So it's understandable that Moses would say in verse 11, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? I'm convinced if God had appeared to Moses 40 years before and handed him this challenge, Moses would have said, I'm your man. But by this time in his life, he was convinced that he had nothing to bring to this situation. He didn't know who he was. We would say today he has an identity problem. He didn't have any sense of worth. No value. No resources. Now the interesting thing is that God doesn't tell him who he is. We would. If someone comes to us and they say, I'm not qualified to do a certain thing, we say, oh, yes, you are. And we bring out all the statistics. Here are your assets over here. And here are your liabilities here. These are the things that you've done. And certainly, if you apply yourself, you can do it. You have the gifts, the training, the ability, the personality. You can do it. And on that basis, we decide what things we can do and what things we can't do. If we're not equipped, then we're disqualified. We won't touch anything that we're not qualified for. But if we're adequately trained and equipped, then we'll tackle this thing. God doesn't tell him who he is. God just says, I am with you. You know that? And he said, certainly I will be with you. And this should be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain, that is at Sinai. He says two things. I'll be with you and you won't. There'll be no proof that I'm with you until the deed is done. You have to act now. And the certainty comes later. We want God somehow to vouchsafe his promises to us so that without any step of faith, we can venture ourselves. God says, I'm not going to do that. All you have is my word. I'll be with you. Literally, I am with you. That's all Moses needs. That was the answer to Moses' question. He doesn't need to know who he is. All he needs to know is that God is with him. And therefore, whatever he has to face, he's adequate for it. Even the impossible. And Moses has another question in verse 13. And Moses said to God, behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is your name? What shall I say to them? Moses' first question is, who am I? And God says, it doesn't matter. I am with you. And Moses' second question is, well, then who are you? It's nice to know that you're going along, but so what? Now, the question that Moses asks is not, what is your name? Because Moses knew that the name of the Lord, the covenant God of Israel, was Jehovah or Yahweh. He knew that. All Israel knew that. That name was revealed to the patriarchs. What he did not know, though, was the meaning of the name. And that's the the interrogative pronoun that he uses. The particular term means, what is the meaning? Explain to me the meaning of the name. And so God explains that his name means, I am. The name Jehovah or Yahweh is the third person singular form of a verb that means he is. He's saying, I am. I am whatever you need. That's why it's important that I go with you. You don't need to reckon on your resources. Whatever you need, that's what I am. Do you need courage? That's what I am. Do you need wisdom? That's what I am. Whatever resource you're lacking, that's what I am. Therefore, tell him I am sent you. And by that he's saying that that ought to be the pattern of our life, because he goes on to say in verse 15, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. That's the way we ought to approach every problem. He is. I'm not, he is, therefore I am. Whatever I need, that's what God is. Now Moses is told that he's to go to the elders and deliver this message, and together they're to go to the king of Egypt and request that they be allowed to go into the wilderness for 3 days' journey to sacrifice to the Lord. But he's told in advance that the king of Egypt wouldn't let them go. No surprises. Moses still has a problem. He actually didn't hear what the Lord said, I believe. The Lord starts to describe what's going to happen over the next few months. You're going to go to the elders. The elders will go with you to Egypt, to Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh will not let you go, but he'll be compelled to let you go, and you'll deliver the people. And Moses is still hanging up on the first statement, you'll go to the elders. And the thought that occurs to him is this, the elders won't believe me. Who am I? If they remember me at all, they'll remember me as the man that got him into so much trouble before. They won't believe that I have the credentials to deliver my people. Have you ever felt that way? I really don't have the authority to expect anyone to believe me or listen to me. No credentials. Oh, if I just had better training, if I was a little brighter, if I could just lose a little weight, then people would listen to me. A little better position in life, a little better paying job, a little more education, then people would really listen to me. You see, when Moses raises this issue, God doesn't go back to his background to remind him that he has the equivalent of a PhD. He does something else. Verse 2 of chapter 4, the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. And he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail. It's not normally the way you pick up a snake. So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. And this became the staff of God from this point on. It's always referred to in that way. In order that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you. And the Lord furthermore said to him, now put your hand into your bosom. So he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, it was leprous like snow. Then he said, put your hand into your bosom again. So he put his hand into his bosom again. And when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. And it shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. And it shall be that if they will not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. These three signs are designated in this passage as a voice. If you have an American Standard translation, you'll notice the margin of in the margin by verse 8 under number 2, side note 2, the word is voice, the voice of the last sound, sign. These miraculous signs were God's voice to the people. They were God's affirmation that Moses was the man that God had called. You see what God is saying? The sign of authority in our life, the credential in our life, is the capacity to do supernatural things, to do extraordinary things, to do things that no one else can do, things that cannot be explained on the basis of our education or our personality. There was nothing in Moses' past that would qualify him or equip him to turn the water of the Nile into blood. The court wizards could accomplish the first, but not the second or the third sign. No one had ever been cured of leprosy, ever, in the whole history of mankind. Moses would do something that no one had ever done before. You see what God is saying? The thing that will make people listen to you is not your office or your education or your personality, but your capacity as you act in faith to do the extraordinary, to do things that no one else can do. If you can be poised and restful and peaceful in the midst of this age, it's not that you don't understand the situation. It's that you're tied into a source of power that no one else has. You see that? If you can be peaceful and restful and quiet when your business is shaking apart financially, when your home is coming to pieces, when your kids are being bombarded on every side by every conceivable evil influence, there's something extraordinary about you. And people will wonder, what is it that makes that person respond that way? The great miracle today is not walking on water or turning staffs into serpents. It's a quality of life, a supernatural quality of life that is the result of our awareness that God is. You see that? The Pharisees asked Jesus, "What shall we do the works of God?" Jesus said, "This is the work of God, that you believe in me whom he has sent." That is, keep on believing. Keep on acting out of my strength. Keep on relying upon me. The result, Jesus said, is that you will do the works of God. That's the only way to do God's works. How audacious of us to think we can do God's works by our own strength. The only one who can do God's works is God. And so as we count on Him, people will look at our lives and they'll see the work of God in us. They'll see God-likeness in the midst of a world that's disintegrating. And that will be our authority. We can't say I'm disqualified because I don't have the background. My appearance is all wrong. We can't. Our authority resides in our faith. That's what will compel a hearing. Now Moses has a fourth problem. Verse 10, Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent. Neither recently nor in time past nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." Moses is saying here that he's never been able to express himself clearly. He's heavy of speech, heavy of tongue. He may have had a speech impediment. And he was fearful lest that so inhibit him that he's unable to fulfill the commission. God says, "It's no problem to me." As a matter of fact, that deficiency is a created deficiency. I'm the one that made you that way. I did it. Verse 11, the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth, or who makes him dumb or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say." God says, "I know you're that way. I made you that way. Because it's when you're weak that you're strong." That's a strange paradox that Paul highlights in 2 Corinthians. Paul had a similar affliction, in his case, probably an eye disease. It was a terribly disabling thing. And he thought, if I could just get rid of this thing, then I would have power. Then my life would really count. And so he besought the Lord to take it away, and God said, "No. Because you're My strength is made perfect in your weakness. And so Moses said, therefore I will be content with weakness. Because when I am weak, then I am strong. That doesn't mean that we have to go about saying we're weak. That's not the point. But that's where we begin. I'm weak. God is. Therefore, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. There is no task that's impossible. No assignment that's beyond his resources. Moses has one final problem, but he said, please, Lord, now send the message by whomever thou wilt. Sounds very pious. But he's not volunteering. This is a Hebrew idiom that means send somebody else. And it says, then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. And only then. God wasn't angry when Moses felt weak, when he felt inequipped, when he lacked the credentials, when he felt impotent. That was no problem to God. But what tied God's hands was when Moses said, I'm simply not available. Send somebody else. And the great thing about this passage is that God doesn't leave it there. Because he goes on to tell him that he will use him as God in Aaron's life, that he would send Aaron and as his associate, and that Aaron would be the spokesman. God would speak through Moses, through Aaron. The passage goes on to tell us that Moses went. He departed. He went back to Egypt. And what this says to me is that God not only is determined to fulfill all of his expectations in us, he will see to it that we make ourselves available. He won't rest until we're willing to submit. He didn't write Moses off. He didn't set him aside and say, all right, I'll find somebody else. He said, I'll see to it that Moses does what I've called him to do. And so he set him on the road to Egypt. And we know through subsequent history, as it's developed in the book of Exodus, what this man accomplished. He is the leader in Israel. Jews look back to Abraham today as the great leader, the one who around whom the nation was formed. Where did his resources come from? Where did his power to accomplish those deeds come from? It came from the God who is. Now most of you this week are facing some circumstances way beyond your powers. If you aren't, God will see to it that you do. Me too. God's not frustrated by your lack of knowledge. He's not frustrated by your feeling of weakness. The only thing that will frustrate him is if you say, I'm just not available. Thank you. Send somebody else. That's all. Ian Thomas, in commenting on this passage, refers to the fact that God appeared to Moses in a common, ordinary bush, an acacia tree, not a palm tree, but just an ordinary, run-of-the-mill, garden-variety desert bush. The point being, any old bush will do, as long as God's in it. That's the point. Now, what has God called you to do this week? Remember, He is. He is everything you need. And therefore, you can do all things through Christ, who strengthens you. Let's stand together, shall we? It's good to be reminded again this morning that we're related to the one who sees and who knows and who is. And it's your delight to equip us for every good work. Thank you for creating us to that end. We thank you in Christ's name. Amen.